Hey Caffeinators, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the veterinary field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question, comment, or would like to be a guest on the Vet Tech Cafe, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com, or you can find us at our website, vettechcafe.com. One thing we would ask of you, our listeners, is to rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. We're not exactly sure how or why this helps us, but apparently it does. So without further ado, come on in, grab yourself a cup of coffee, and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Hello, Vet Tech Caffeinators. Thanks so much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. Dave, it's Sunday night, October 18th. How's it going down in North Carolina?
It's going good down here. It's actually, you know, getting down more into fall, starting to be a little bit colder.
Yeah, a little crispy.
Starting to think about having some more fires outside. So it's
nice.
For those of you that love fall, I'm kind of on the fence about fall, but I enjoy it. I enjoy a little bit cooler weather. Not quite as cold as winter, but the fall's good.
With the colder weather, have you been able to do any more running for the Not One More Vet race?
Yes, I just finished 5.5 miles this afternoon. Nice. So I'm up around, I've got maybe 30 or 40 miles left to go.
Fantastic.
How are you doing up there? You're getting started to pack, right?
Yeah. We leave on Saturday, so the apartment is now, I'm glad we don't do this on Zoom because... it's a minefield here, but as it goes with a cross country move, but it's getting crispy up here too. It's really, really wonderful outside. I hope to get a good ride in tomorrow. I think Molly and I want to go for a ride, so hopefully get some.
How are you doing on your miles? You almost at the end?
No, not quite. I haven't been able to ride for the last several days, so hopefully I can get some miles in this week before we leave. And we're actually taking our bikes on the car, so maybe we can get a couple miles in on the road.
You're not going to do that.
We'll see. I mean, we're staying with, you know, at some places a couple of days, so hopefully we'll be able to get some. Yeah, so hopefully we'll be able to get some riding in. So
nice.
So we'll see. You got a cup of coffee going down there?
I do. I got my iced coffee.
Nice. I'm actually, I know this isn't the tap room, but I'm having a coffee stout because the Packers are just getting obliterated today. So I felt like I needed a coffee beer instead.
We have to double check, make sure we have a license for that in the cafe.
Yeah, I know. It's behind the counter. Hopefully nobody's
behind the counter.
Well, what do you think? Should we go ahead and get started?
Yeah, let's get started.
Yeah, I'm super excited for tonight's episode. It's something we haven't done quite yet. So tonight we have Molly Kripe Burt coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. She's an RVT and a VTS in equine veterinary nursing at Purdue University as a surgical technologist there in the large animal hospital. She's worked as a treatment nurse, a med-surg nurse throughout her 10 years plus of employment there, predominantly interested in equine orthopedic emergencies and the intensive post-operative nursing care, which I'm sure jives with what you and I like to do as well.
Yeah.
And also is a self-described adrenaline junkie. I did that. She graduated from their vet tech program at Purdue with an associate's in 06 and a bachelor's in 07 and got her equine VTS in 2015. And in her spare time, loves adventuring with her pound hound and her husband and is an ultra endurance cyclist. That's mouthful. So while also finding time to recline in a hammock, which sounds awesome. So Molly, thank you so much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. Welcome. Can we get you a cup of coffee before we start? I know you're on call tonight, so you might need one or you might not want one. I don't know.
I actually don't drink coffee, but you said something about a coffee stout. So if I could have that, that's more my jams.
Okay. There you go.
All right.
On call, even still, I can still take like a wee nip here and there.
Absolutely. It's a crisp fall night. Why not?
Yeah, no, I was going to say that's my kind of drink. So
how has 2020 worked out for you? Because I know the rest of us with everything that's going on right now, how has that fared for you guys in the equine field?
Oh, Lord. I think it's a garbage fire all over. I think that... Honestly, I can't speak for the rest of the equine industry. What I can give an example of is what I've personally experienced with my team working at teaching hospital. It's been pretty difficult because all of our students went home indefinitely back in March. Mm-hmm. And since teaching hospitals rely heavily on student work for paperwork, treatments, handling, et cetera, we found ourselves on a whole new level of being understaffed. And so then you throw in the complications with budgeting snags and hiring freezes in the university level. we were pretty stuck there for a couple of months. It was more than a marathon, we'll put it that way, because there was no end in sight. But then we did get our fourth year of vet students and third year vet tech students back at the end of July. And so it's been such a good thing to have them back. I know they've been struggling with getting caught up, but they'll be fine. We'll be fine. I would say on a different level of teamwork, what has become very apparent to me is just how my tiny little team in my hospital is that we've all pulled together in different ways this past year. And the tiny little joys that we find, the dark humor, you know, bringing somebody a cookie. we have weekly order out sessions from Panera. It's anything that kind of brings us a little bit of joy and reminds us that we're still human has been super comforting. I feel a little unqualified even speaking on behalf of the entirety of the equine technician population. And so I would always encourage anybody, you know, to speak out about their own experiences and their own truth. Because I have no idea what's going on the outside world.
Absolutely. And I've heard this, I just finished up my time at Tufts, and I've heard the same thing from, I mean, I know how it was in a small animal hospital. I know for the large animal technicians and doctors, I definitely heard a similar story, you know, in terms of all the students going home and relying so heavily on the students and really having to regroup and pull together. And then, of course, in terms of caseload, it was busier than it probably had been in a while. And
what happened? I don't.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Before we get going too much deeper, would you mind taking a couple of minutes and just kind of taking us through your career path and kind of where you started in veterinary medicine all the way up through kind of your VTS and kind of how you got into equine med and all that fun stuff?
Yeah. I understand that both of you have quite a bit of experience too, so I'm sure you look back on your history like, oh, where do I begin?
Yeah, exactly.
Always had a big interest in horses when I was a little girl. I wasn't actually raised with them. My parents didn't own horses, so it wasn't like born into it. But they did what they could to provide me with the experience I needed through 4-H. And honestly, I was going to go the route of like journalism. Turns out the term for that would be investigative journalism, not clickbait journalism in these day and age. So right. Yep. Before you worry about me. Anyway, so my dog, my senior year of high school, I've lived in Indiana. I was out in the sticks, and somehow she got herself between the sights of a gun and was shot in the face. She survived, but in like rushing her to the local emergency clinic and seeing how the veterinary technician really was the hands-on caretaker inspired me to look a little bit more critically into what I wanted to do with my future. I put in my application to Purdue's vet tech program as well as Moorhead. I was accepted to Purdue, and since that's a local university for me, that's where I went. Once I saw the goings-on of the large animal hospital, I was hooked. There was just something very intense and magical about how the entire hospital ran. I did do my externship in small animal. I'm not going to lie, the general practice in the anal glands drove me crazy.
That's fair.
Yeah, like, you know, maybe if I was going to be an emergency critical care technician, that would be one thing in small animal. But when I found out that there was a position for a part-time weekend treatment technician opening up in the large animal hospital while I was finishing up my bachelor's degree, I jumped on that as fast as I could. Like, look, here's my in. Got my foot in the door there. I did an internship at Woodside Equine Clinic while I was finishing up my schooling, and that was down in Virginia. A position opened up for a full-time treatment technician on second shift at Purdue. Right at the end, as I was graduating with my bachelor's degree, I applied for that. I was offered a position there and accepted it. Worked in that position for several years before applying for what's considered a versa technician at Purdue. And that is a technician that works on treatment crew. It works on medicine and surgery. And so in that position, I was doing on-call work, shift work, medical care, surgical care, on-call, all of it. And then when a position to open surgery, I went ahead and applied for that one. That's really when I kind of settled into my groove, really found that I loved the drive and the organization and the surgical nursing care that comes in that position. I knew that while I was in school that I wanted to do a little bit more advanced education. obviously there's not really anything specific to veterinary technology in terms of a master's degree. But when I found out about the academies and the specializations that are available for technicians, I really started looking into that. What I wanted to accomplish there was specific to something that I wanted to do with the rest of my life. So large animal. At the time, the Academy for Surgical Technicians did not have their equine or large animal subspecialty. So I looked into the Academy for Equine Veterinary Nursing Technicians. And I had been a member of the Association, or the American Association for Equine Technicians, which is a society through NAVTA, since I had been a student and had made a lot of connections that way. And it made sense for me to go ahead and get this specialty in equine veterinary nursing, because if I ever left Purdue, I was not planning on going back into a teaching hospital. Not for any other reason than just Purdue has treated me well, but I wouldn't mind going out to private practice and working with horses only. I mean, every technician says it. They went into vet med because they liked animals, not people.
Right. We say that all the time.
Yep.
All the time. And teaching is very humbling. Don't get me wrong. I enjoy it. I wouldn't change it. If I didn't want to work in a teaching hospital, I wouldn't have. I'd have moved on a long time ago. So what intrigued me about the equine veterinary nursing was that it was simply more than just internal medicine nursing, surgical nursing, anesthesia nursing. It encompassed the whole spectrum of what equine technicians do. And that was why I made that decision. In my position as a surgical technician at Purdue, I couldn't, with good intention, apply for this academy without making some connections with other departments. As you know, working in a university, we are very specialized. Like, I'm only in surgery. I don't do anesthesia. I don't do radiographs. The Academy for Equine Veterinary Nursing Technicians is encompassing the whole thing. So general practice, surgery, medicine, critical care, anesthesia, diagnostic imaging, theriogenology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Wow. And with all of these different categories, I started, like I said, making connections and forming relationships, focusing my continuing education on more than just what would benefit my career at the moment, but expanding it beyond that. And so, let's see. So in 2015, yeah, I was able, I felt qualified. So more than just the minimum qualifications of the academy, but as a professional, I felt qualified to apply. My application was accepted. I sat for the exam in December of 2015, passed, had a party.
That is what you do.
We can relate to that.
Yeah, I was going to say, was your exam in Vegas?
San Diego.
San Diego, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a good place too. I honestly, I'm not going back to Vegas unless somebody forces me. Like, I was glad to have been there. I'm not going back. after I got my VTS, I just stayed the course at Purdue. I've applied what I know to making, or not making, I guess they make themselves, but applying that passion and that knowledge and experience to teaching not just the vet students that I see on the floor, but also the veterinary technology students that rotate through the hospital. And they may never want to look at a horse again when they graduate, but it's still important for them to respect.
To do it, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they got to do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What's been kind of cool with the opportunities that have opened up with the academy is the ability to not just educate people that I'm training, mentoring, teaching at the hospital, but also on a local level, speaking at our local conferences, particularly one that Purdue puts on. So that's kind of more of a state level. And then also speaking at national conferences. The Midwest Vet Conference was a big one this past year. And then also at the AAVT annual convention that's in association with the American Association of Equine Practitioners. So it's not for everybody. Like, public speaking is not for everybody,
right?
By all means, but just by earning a VTS and then working alongside people, you still are teaching and you're still educating them and teaching. So yeah, I guess that's
cool.
My career path in a nutshell.
So I have a couple questions about the VTS. You said that the EVN is kind of an all-encompassing thing. Is it split off? You know, in small animal, we have internal medicine, we have anesthesia, we have surgery. Are there split-offs of that or subsets of the equine veterinary nursing
specialty?
There is not. It's all just encompassing?
It's all just encompassing.
Are there any plans to do that, or is it that's kind of where it's at right now.
That's where it's at. And I do think that there's a certain level of pride that we have in that. If you look at major equine specialty hospitals, Reed-Riddle and Hagerstown in Lexington, Kentucky, and all of the big names out on the West Coast, whose names I can't particularly remember at the moment, but like there are huge equine hospitals all over this country.
Yeah.
And their technicians may work in like a university, surgery, medicine, whatever. But for the most part, they are going to be expected to assist or to run anesthesia cases, circulate for surgeries, to act as on-call technicians for emergencies. They may work as treatment technicians on the critical care cases. They may work off of the truck in field work and still have to know everything that I know, but I'm working in-house and have a roof over my head. So it's not just a general practice specialty, and it's not just a specifically designed specialty. This is created for the technicians who are working in specialty referral practices and wearing many, many hats, I would say. All of the hats, they've got all of the tools in their tool belt. So, no.
Cool.
I don't believe that there's any chance of us creating subspecialties from there, at least at this time. I will say that.
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, who knows? When did the VTS in EVN or ballpark kind of come to be? Like, when did that academy start? And how many members do you guys have?
Oh gosh, well.
or again, a ballpark.
Yeah, no, I. So there was a group of approximately 11 charter members that got together in 2009. And worked with NAFTA and were put in provisional status in 2010. Over the years, we've had approximately 12 to 13 more applicants successfully accepted into our ranks. And it does make us a very small academy.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a lot of growth over a short period of time. That's something that the current academy board, which I'm on, is attempting to fix. We're looking at recruitment. We're looking at encouragement and kind of demystifying the process. It is a difficult process. It's intended to be difficult, but it's not supposed to be impossible. So we want to, you know, make sure that everybody understands what that looks like.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Cool. So as we, you know, you kind of alluded to this early on, like when we think about the veterinary technician profession right now, I think there's a whole lot of different major topics that are out there, things like Veterinary Nurse Initiative or unionization, like we talked about in the episode that's actually releasing tonight, a whole bunch of different things that are going on. Like, where do you see, from your point of view in equine nursing, where do you see the veterinary technician profession right now? Do you see like a huge shortfall of available techs? Do you see, you know, do you see any major problems that maybe people in small animal don't recognize? Like, where do you see the veterinary technician profession right now? Just through your eyes.
Well, I'm going to try not to go down too many rabbit holes. And I'll try and I might have to put a pin in something and circle back around to it. I would say that I might be a bit disenfranchised, particularly after this year. So I don't want to speak on behalf of my academy.
Of course.
Especially in this topic. But I do think that the veterinary profession as a whole seems to be a bit adrift. I've been particularly skeptical of the Veterinary Nursing Initiative and how that's worked out over the past several years. I think there was good intentions in an effort to unify the profession, but unfortunately, I think the reality is that unless there's an effort to make equal credentialing across all 50 states, it's not going to matter what we are called, technicians, nurses, whatever, because the name is not going to be consistently protected across federal or state practice acts. And I don't believe that this is going to benefit equine technicians either. I'm sure that the small animal colleagues can also attest to this, that on-the-job trained technicians or uncredentialed technicians are going to be lost somehow in this. And that's going to severely impact how veterinary practices not only receive whatever initiative that was being made or might be made in the future, but also is going to impact the economies in some ways. And honestly, if the veterinarians are not behind any initiative that we have, it's not going to work. And I think that particularly in the equine industry, there has to be a backing of equine practitioners for this to work, because so many states that have a large equine population do not go through traditional routes to credential their technicians, or they don't require it at all. Mm. So there are going to be veterinary technicians who are doing the work that I do that are just as talented as me, who are going to be left out of this conversation.
Yeah.
And there needs to be a broader understanding of how something like this is going to impact everybody. I do believe that for a person to work medically on an animal, they need to have credentials. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm just living in the gray area, if you will.
Sure, sure, no.
I can't expect the equine industry to withstand exclusion of a huge population that is not credentialed at this time.
Right.
And that would be in poor taste. I can't think of another word. It would be in poor taste to exclude them from the future.
Well, it doesn't benefit them to, because you're, and we talk about this in small animal all the time, is you say, okay, non-credentialed people can't work in the hospital, then you lose easily half of your employees.
Right.
So
right.
Yeah.
It just doesn't benefit them.
Yeah. No. And I mean, you have to think about the history of our profession as a whole, not just in, you know, small versus large or whatever. Was it in the 80s or the 90s? Honestly, I can't recall, but there was a major grandfathering in of people who were working as technicians who perhaps didn't have schooling so that they could have this registered or certified licensed veterinary technician status in certain states. And we might be getting onto that point now where we need to grandfather a traditionally on the job trained technician in so that we can move forward, but it's not going to happen from what was proposed with NAFTA. I'm not a political game player. I don't see how this is going to benefit both the large animal and the equine aspects of the profession.
Sure. It's an interesting point because so I'm originally from California, and just as recently as 2009, we had what they called the limited term eligibility window, which there was a perceived shortage of RVTs in the state of California. And so that year, the whole calendar year, as long as you met minimum requirements of, which basically was a couple of college courses, but mostly based on experience, you were able to sit for the RVT exam. Because at the time, in 2009, we didn't use the VTNE in California. We had our own state exam. But there was another kind of path that year for grandfathering to get some of those that kind of, as you say, that have been doing this for so long and are as talented and skilled and knowledgeable as anybody else that's credentialed, to try to get them credentials. And it was a little bit of a boost that year. I don't think it was as many as maybe they had hoped, but you know, might be something to consider kind of going forward too.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting that you mentioned the whole, like, we just can't seem to find technicians to fill the positions that need to be filled. And understaffing, there's just not as many out there as we need. And I think that that's really felt in the equine industry as well, because many veterinary technology programs are not focusing even half as much energy as they should be on large animal topics. So what California proposed makes a lot of sense on a national scale for my equine colleagues who maybe didn't take, you know, the university route to get their credentialing, but are qualified to work as technicians otherwise. That would fill a huge hole in, you know, a national standard.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, the AVMA accreditation is focused on small animal topics more. Purdue University has one of the best veterinary technology programs in the country. And even still, in my experience, what I've witnessed, and in my humble opinion, we're still not having our technicians graduate with the level of skill that they need to just jump into an equine practice. And we get applicants all the time for these positions in the hospital on the floor, and they say, I just want to get more large animal experience. And it's like, man, like, I could teach you everything that you need to know, but if you're not comfortable handling a 1500 pound animal,
right,
we have to start all over again.
Yeah.
And so if the national accrediting committees want to see all aspects of our profession filled, then they're going to need to start requiring veterinary technology programs to take more seriously the knowledge and the experience that their students get, so that they can fill that hole. Otherwise, we're going to continue having technicians hired from off the farm to do the work that we do. And, you know, it's worked, but if you want a national credential, you have to start from the foundation. I would selfishly plug that the American Association for Equine Vet Techs has a great certifying online school. It's more of a certificate. It's not any form of credential. It doesn't make anybody more qualified for a position, other than the fact that it does give interested parties more equine technician-based knowledge than they would if their program had just put a diploma in their hands and said, you're ready to go. So for those of you who are listening and interested in equine medicine, I would say that even if you didn't grow up with horses, if you didn't have parents that, you know, got you involved in 4-H or whatever, there's still a place for you to learn, and that tapping into the AAVT and looking into their certifying programs is a darn good place to start. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of the school that I teach at. We have a large animal husbandry class that gets taught. They get a little bit of that information in anatomy and physiology, but other than that, there's really not a whole lot of large animal courses. Is that a problem throughout the education system? Do you feel like that's something that's lacking everywhere, or is that just maybe my school's doesn't focus on it as much?
No, I think that's a nationwide issue.
I really
do. Yeah. I mean, you have to follow the money. Right. Where are people going to go? They're probably going to go to small animals, so you have to kind of cater to that. And I'm in the understanding that many programs are on kind of accelerated learning programs, which is great. But if they don't prioritize large animal, there's not going to be that knowledge base there for them. And I'm not saying, like, you know, only teach large animal, obviously, but comparative anatomy, comparative physiology, it should be more than just like a 5-second briefing. And it's very difficult, I think, for teachers to do more with less, which is every university or school's standard. And so I guess to that point, it also kind of is up to the student to meet the professors, meet the teachers halfway. You know, if you really want to do this thing, get your foot in the door somewhere, go learn how to muck stalls, and then you get some hands-on experience and go do some of your own self-study. That's what I did. I don't understand what P3 is. What does it look like? Anyway.
Well, and the other thing that I wanted to ask you, my girlfriend Robin, she is a vet, and she spent a time as a traveling equine vet. And I asked her before we came on, I said, what was your experience using technicians? She says, I never really had a technician. I had like assistants that would help out, but for the most part, I did all the work. Is that something where the equine technicians are pretty much in the hospital, and then when they go through, you know, the traveling on-call equine vets that get called out in the middle of the night, do they just not have technicians? Is that not a path for technicians in the equine world, or am I getting that wrong?
Oh, no, I would say that that's fairly standard. I would also, based on what I've seen and experienced and heard kind of through the grapevine, is that that is also kind of going by the wayside. I've, you know, worked with people who've worked in practices, and I've worked at a practice myself where there were assistants and technicians assigned to every ambulatory truck that went out, so that the veterinarian was not handling horses on their own or relying on the owners to handle the horses. Those technicians perhaps don't do as higher level of technical skills that an in-house technician might be asked to do. I would say that the trend that I see, anyway, with our vet students graduating and going out into practice, is that they want to have qualified, experienced people working for them, whether they be assistants or technicians. And so hopefully what's happening is that, kind of as the, I don't mean to insult anybody with a statement, the good old boys club is starting to retire.
I completely know where you're coming from.
I know exactly
what
you're
talking about. Yeah.
Like trying really hard not to get fired. So as that generation starts to retire and new generations take up the wheel in ambulatory and field practices, that they not only recognize the importance of qualified technicians, but also will advocate for them to be hired on and to be compensated appropriately. I think that's a very difficult point in large animal and equine practices, is that by and large, it's difficult to get owners to agree to paying for a $10,000 surgery. That oftentimes, farmers, while really valuing their livestock, perhaps don't value medical care beyond the standard general practice. And so I have heard many comments in the past about bills not being paid. Mm. I don't mean to disparage my my equine clients at all, but just, it's one thing when Fluffy needs dialysis. It's another thing when, you know, perhaps you're backyard pony needs a $10,000 surgery, and you're going to do it for the emotional, like the owner is going to do it for the emotional reasoning, but then not be able to pay the bill at the end of the day. And so it can be hard for equine practitioners to make ends meet, to be able to hire a credentialed technician and pay them what they're worth and be able to provide benefits for them.
Oh boy, there's another rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Yep, there we go. I knew we were going there. So, yeah, I'll end it there. You guys can go down the rabbit hole if you want.
No, that's fair.
Yeah. I don't really know how PC I need to be. I'm trying so hard not to be critical because I love what I do and I love who I work for and the clients and what they value in their animals. There's just some sketchy stuff that happens.
Sure.
Just like, man, what is going on?
Yeah. So Molly, I realize that your typical day as an equine veterinary technician might not be a representation of all equine vet techs, but for you as an equine veterinary technician, what does your typical day look like at the hospital?
Oh, just like a small animal technician's day? No, I really don't even know. Because like I said, I got out of that as fast as I could. What I would say is that my day begins just like pretty much anybody else's. I restock the treatment and the surgical rooms since I'm the surgical nurse. I communicate with my residents and my senior clinicians and any of the other technicians about the flow of the day, who's going to go where, who's going to be responsible for what. Because I have the teaching aspect thrown into it, I do gather my little tech students. I like to call them techlets.
Nice.
They're like little mini-me's.
I'm going to have to remember that.
Okay. Yeah. Feel free to take that one. I haven't copywritten it yet, so you don't owe me any royalties. So I take the little techlets and try and get them up to speed. We always make this plan and then we punctuate that with until the next colic rolls in, because that always just throws a huge wrench in the plan. We prepare for the cases and then we get started on setup. So if I'm on the surgical receiving service that day, I usually assist with lameness examinations, upper airway examinations, your general surgical cases. So in taking something that might go to surgery the next day or doing standing surgery that day, I like to call lameness exams our bread and butter of the hospital. That's basically anywhere from handling horses for the physical exams, trotting them up and down the breezeway, preparing sites for perineural injections with a local anesthetic, assisting with radiographs or ultrasounds, and then preparing for the treatments on whatever we have found that's wrong with them. So that could be joint injections of steroids, preparation of PRP or IRAP, shockwave, etc. If we're doing upper airway endoscopy, that could be that could morph into something like, oh, we're going to do a standing laser of an entrapped epiglottis, or diagnosis of laryngeal hemiplegia that requires a tie-back surgery the next day. Sometimes that really goes down the rabbit hole of putting the horses on the treadmill or using the overground scope and watching their upper airway in action while they're exercising. So any of the cases that are dropped off for surgery is a pre-anesthetic or pre-surgical workup, kind of as needed, making sure that they're healthy enough to go under general anesthesia, and then getting ready for the next day, which would be a surgical day. Then I'm responsible for setting up, managing, circulating, and cleaning the surgical suites, and then I do assist with induction and recovery from anesthesia. If I were working in internal medicine that day, that would be neurologic exams, lower airway endoscopies, usually morphing into trach washes or bronchial alveolar lavages, gastroscopies. The internal medicine technicians at Purdue also act as kind of the catch-all for incoming emergencies. So given the season, it could go anything from neonatal emergencies to colics to colitis cases and beyond. And that can turn their quiet day into a bit of a train wreck.
Yeah.
If I was on the treatment team, that would consist of direct patient care and monitoring of all hospitalized patients, life checks, walk-bys, all the way up to colic watches, neonatal care, post-operative nursing care. Essentially, that would be the equivalent of an ICU technician. And so for, you know, the equine technicians that work in an ambulatory service, they would do all of that, but from an ambulatory truck. So the way I look at it is really, really, really uncomfortable conditions in December through March. And therefore those challenges look a lot different. Anywhere from scheduling farm visits, the facilities in which they practice, and the safety of those facilities, and the ability to treat those severe cases. And oftentimes the ability to manage and treat those cases result in a referral to a referral specialty practice or a university. So
okay.
Hopefully that sums it all up.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you mentioned the ambulatory, what did you call it? Are they essentially
ambulatory
ambulances?
Field service.
Okay.
What's that? Yeah.
Essentially like an ambulance?
Well, without us actually hauling them in. Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, to give everybody a picture, sorry, this is like so commonplace to me, I kind of forget that like many people actually haven't seen this. It's a pickup truck with the bed has compartments in it. drawers full of equipment and medicine and diagnostic equipment. And so then the veterinarian and their team, so for us, that would be a technician and a handful of students, then drive out to the farms and do general practice kind of husbandry things. So vaccines, wellness checks, papers for traveling. So that's a big thing that horses and the horse industry does is traveling from races to shows, both national and international level. Dentistry care. And then also they will be the first responders in the event of an emergency. So if, let's say, so-and-so goes out to their field and they see their horses ran through the fence and they've got gaping wounds, they'll call their veterinarian, who will then come out and assess the wounds and either treat them there or send them into a referral facility for more advanced treatment. Hmm. And that's kind of where we come in on the surgical service side.
So thinking about all those things and thinking about, you know, you're talking to two guys that are, we have horses here at the farm. Jeff doesn't really have any experience with large animal, I don't believe. Just kind of thinking about the whole reason that we did this podcast is we wanted to talk about issues that technicians face in the field and in our jobs. Not being in that realm that you're in and so entrenched in, what different challenges do equine technicians face that we wouldn't typically see in small animal? Because I know you've worked in both sides. Mm-hmm. What do you guys see as big challenges for you as equine technicians that we may not experience as small animal technicians?
Oh, God. I would say that that's just the sheer physicality of the job. I mean, don't get me wrong, like 190-pound, like how big do your Great Pyrenees dogs get? Like the biggest dog you've ever seen? I wouldn't want to lift that up on a table either. I wouldn't want to restrain it if it didn't want to be have blood drawn. But there is a very, very big difference between like facing off with a hyperreactive buzzsaw cat and facing off with a horse that doesn't want to do what you're asking it to do.
Yeah.
If you've never been smashed by an equine patient, you really can't appreciate how quickly you're taken out of the game by one stupid handling mistake or a misjudgment on your patient's behavior. Mm. And I've noticed that the older I get, the less I bounce. So I'm a little bit, more firm about what's happening around me, because it has happened to me, and I don't want to have to go back to feeling vulnerable and injured and wounded and nothing more than a brain on a box. Like, I don't know. So if you kind of throw that into the mix, in addition to all of the, like the burnout and the longevity issues that all vet techs face, like everybody deals with that. The long hours, the demanding situations, you know, it's pretty exhausting work, right? But if you throw that in there, I think that's why we see a lot of kind of turnover in the equine sector. And so, you know, you throw that in with the historically low hourly pay and salaries, mixed levels of benefits, and kind of a general underutilization of technical skills. I would say that those are some of the bigger issues that, or the bigger challenges that we would face. Okay. I don't know. There is kind of this thing where, like, you know, you hear these side comments from small animal technicians, like, well, try getting a 25 gauge needle in a kitten vein. And it's like, have you ever had an emergency blood transfusion on a 5-pound teacup Yorkie doodle? Like, no, ma'am, I haven't. Like, I really haven't. I haven't experienced that. But have you ever gotten a 10-gauge catheter in a horse with a PCV of 70 and a total protein of 8.5? And trying to throw its 1,500-pound self on the ground because it's colicking so bad? Well, right. Like, it's a two-sided coin.
Yeah.
Yes.
Working with prey species is a whole different ballgame, right? Mm. Like when they weigh 10 pounds what you do and their immediate reaction is to fight or flee from you, you have to be smarter and you have to work a little bit more patiently than perhaps you do with a dog, because it's not like here, kitty, kitty. It's not like sit, stay, Fido. It's like you have to have a bigger picture of what they're seeing and see it through their eyes. Like, that's not a radiology machine that's looking at them. That is probably something that's going to attack them and kill them. And what are they going to do but run you over to get away from it?
Yeah.
And so you have to kind of work within those bounds to accommodate that. Be more patient, have a better sense of understanding of where they're coming from, handling them in ways that instills confidence in them and not more fear. So a great example is that if you've got a horse coming into the hospital and they're blowing and they're snorting and their ears are up and they're twitching, that's not the time to get after them about being bad. That's the time for you to be calm and say, okay, buddy, we got this. I am a calm presence here and you can follow my lead. But when we start getting newer handlers and newer technicians in that just want to like, you know, crank on their halter and say like, whoa, Nelly, stop. You're freaking me out. They're like, okay. Why are we so nervous? And just that fear feeds off of each other. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I guess that's my rambling way of saying it, just the sheer physicality of
sure,
it.
Sure.
And you have to be able to take a hit. Like we all get bumped around a little bit. It's not just about, I don't know, making sure that you don't get hit. It's knowing that when you get hit, that you will probably be okay. Gotcha. I say probably, sorry. You'll be okay. It'll be great.
It'll be fine.
It's fine. It's fine.
Well, I can also think of that, like the two horses we have here, like I know both of them very well. They know me. Mm-hmm. I know their little idiosyncrasies. I know Ike is dumb about seeing weird things and Bravo has his own little idiosyncrasies. And I think about that and I think that when I'm in their stalls with them, you know, taking care of them and feeding them and what have you, I think about sometimes that if I ever got into a situation with another horse that I didn't know and didn't know me, I'd probably get my butt kicked because I'm probably complacent with the way that I act around them because I know them and they know me. And if I got into a stall with a strange horse, I'd probably be kind of stupid and probably get my butt kicked.
Well, I mean,
and you deal with that. You probably deal with that every day, right?
Well, yeah, like that's the thing is like I have gotten so complacent sometimes before and I just get out of these situations. I'm like, girl, what the hell were you doing? Like, you know better. And you just got too complacent. And some of them have been really rude wake up calls for me going down the cattle avenue here. I worked on third shift for quite some time and it was during C-section season. So we had a cow who had a C-section and delivered a big bull calf. And he was suffering from hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, HIE, dummy calf syndrome. About called it dummy foal since we've been talking horses so much, but dummy calf syndrome. He was big and he was dumb and he needed to stand up and he didn't know how and he needed a nurse, but he didn't know how. But the more you work with them, the better they get. Well, at 3 a.m, I was thinking like, oh, this isn't a big deal. As long as I keep the calf between me and the cow's in the head catch and the cow is tied up, I'm not going to get kicked. Well, dummy, stupid, complacent me, I got the calf up under the cow. The cow didn't care about the calf. Cow didn't have any mothering instinct at all. She was a horrible mom. May she rest in taco hell heaven. So what she did was she kicked the crap out of the calf and she kicked me into a corner. And you think like calves or cows aren't very flexible. Boy, would you be wrong. Cows can scratch their ears. And she decided to do that through me. And so I was basically penned up against the head catch and the wall. And every time I moved, she'd kick me. And I got my lower half beaten within an inch of its life because I just made a really stupid mistake. Like, of course, this cow who is scared and nervous and in an immense amount of pain wasn't going to care if the calf that she didn't care about was between me or her. I was going to hurt her and she was going to do anything to prevent me from hurting her worse, which of course was not my intention, but how am I supposed to tell a cow that? Right. So I'm not saying this to scare anybody that's interested in working in equine or large animal. It was just more of like, yeah, you're right. We do get complacent and we do forget what we're dealing with, especially when you're tired, especially when you're burnt out, especially when you're not paying attention.
What I know we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier. We were kind of talking about national level and credentialing of technicians. What would your thoughts be about how equine technicians are represented on a national level? Do you feel like they're kind of adequately represented, meaning your opinions are heard and you feel like a national organization or even state organizations adequately reflect your viewpoints, or if not, any ideas on how we can improve that?
Yeah, I am going to say this. I am not a political advocate. I didn't really intend to be the president of the Academy. That said, I do have a lot of passion for what I do. But so, again, I don't feel like my opinions should adequately or accurately reflect my academy.
Sure.
And I have no intention in getting into a fight with anybody on a national level about this, but I don't believe that we are adequately represented on a national level. And I say this coming with a massive qualifier. The American Association for Equine Vet Techs has done a fantastic job advocating for equine technicians. They've formed respected relationships between industry partners and the American Association for Equine Practitioners. And without them, I don't believe that we would have a voice at all. Mm-hmm. That said, they can only do so much, and there needs to be like their efforts need to be met halfway on the national scale. So what I would like to see is better support on kind of the national arena. I would like to see better representation and advocacy. I'm not interested in playing political games, like I said. I'm not really sure that I even have a solution. And I know I don't have time to be part of that solution on a big scale. But what I do see and what I do recognize is that when initiatives are made, when weeks of appreciation are put out there, any advocacy that happens, it's not geared towards those of us working in the equine and large animal sectors. And what I think is helpful is when our veterinarians advocate for us. They are the reason why we have jobs, right?
Right.
I perform nursing care under their direction. And if they are proud of the work that I do, if they appreciate what I do, if they want me to do better and they want more of people like me, then they should take the time to not only appreciate us on a local level, but advocate for us on a national level. So when national organizations come out with Vet Tech Appreciation Week, there should be some more than just my face on, you know, AVMA's website advocating and talking about being a large animal technician. That happened this past week, and I'm very grateful for that opportunity, but I don't see that happening at the level that it should be. When you consider the massive amount of money that is wrapped up in the equine industry in America only, specifically in the thoroughbred racing industry, that is a huge area that is filled with veterinarians and credentialed technicians and assistants helping the economy there. And that does need to be reflected on a national scale. So you guys, you know, the Vet Tech Cafe podcast giving me a platform to talk about that is a damn good start. and just recognizing that there are more animals than just cats and dogs.
Yeah.
I know,
right.
Like I said, I was doing a little bit of research on your podcast. I was hearing that you guys do give a great platform for many, many different topics. So I do commend you on that. So thank you for letting me talk about this.
Yeah.
I would hope that other universities that have credentialed technicians working for them, other, you know, schools that have vet tech programs, I challenge them to give more thought into educating future technicians, future veterinarians about the importance of having properly educated and trained technicians working for them once they get out in general practice. Because it really does start with a foundation, and I do believe it starts with the veterinarians because they have a say in what we make. They have a say in what we're compensated with. They have a say in how we're treated. Yeah.
One other question I have too. I just wrapped up a few years working at Tufts University and of course in a small animal hospital, and we're only separated from the large animal hospital by a large hallway. And sometimes overnight, you know, we'd wander through there or the large animal techs would come through ICU and
see. We've all done that. Had.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitely.
But I really didn't ever get a sense that I had any clue what was going on in their world. Or say, you know, the other direction that they had any clue what was going on in mine. And I also, like, as Dave alluded to earlier, I didn't grow up around horses or large animals. I didn't really have that experience. So anything I got was in school. But I kind of wonder, like, is that kind of your experience as well, being maybe on the other side of the hallway, that you don't see much communication and, like, you know, swapping stories? Like, I never really felt, I'm using air quotes here, but the phrase friendly with the large animal techs, I didn't know them very well. Like, I feel like there's this gap, and I just don't understand why. We have the same job, we just work on different animals.
Yeah, kidney's a kidney, right? Your kidney's going to do the same thing my kidney does. So
yeah, I'm curious, like, if you kind of experienced that as well?
I have used to wander down to small animal ICU on third shift all the time just to say hi, and so that they could come and drag my butt out of a stall if I got pinned in a stall again. It has helped with the College of Vet Med at Purdue. There has been a bigger push, I think, for kind of friendliness across the lines. And so I have developed really good relationships, like professional relationships and friendships with people in other areas that I wouldn't see on a normal basis. So, you know, I work in pretty tight quarters with the diagnostic imaging team and the anesthesia team, obviously, but I didn't realize that, you know, small animal medicine had a dialysis unit until just a couple, you know, weeks or years ago, right? Didn't know that was a thing. So, you know, then I'd go down there during the day during my lunch break just to sit with the dog and the technician while the dog was getting dialysis. And that was kind of a fun way to, I don't know, shoot the shit while on break. And it is a nice thing that they can recognize what we do and we can recognize what they do. And obviously, if you're working in a small animal-only clinic, like, you may not have that opportunity.
Sure.
But surely you're part of a state association that includes several large animal or equine technicians that can be there. We all, a ton of large animal, look a little rough. I've been told I look savage before. So, like, we're just... No, I think actually he was like, you look brutal. You're acting savage, is what he said. And I was like, well, I guess. But we clean up okay. So... it's not about what you have, it's about what you work with, and I clean up okay. I'm still a woman underneath all of the manure. anyway, so I would say that, you know, for the most part, the pandemic has made us a little bit closer, I think, than perhaps we would have in the past, which is weird since it's a very isolating situation that we're in.
Right.
But, you know, there is some camaraderie in the suffering, if you will. And my employer has done some intentional work in making sure that everybody is part of their initiatives. So that, you know, kudos to Purdue for that. I would say that hopefully all employers would try that if they're a mixed animal practice or university, whatever. So. Yeah.
So we're getting down towards, we're almost at an hour now. So
yeah, sorry, I talk a lot.
No, that's
no,
that's
it's fantastic.
Perfectly fine. That's what we want.
Yeah.
So we're kind of going to start to wrap up. And
yeah,
of one of the questions we usually ask is, what lasting impression would you like to give for your fellow equine technicians? How would you want to talk them up or give advice to anyone that's wanting to get into the equine field?
Well, first I would say to my equine technician colleagues, you guys rock. You do a hard job. It's, I think, undervalued. I think it's not seen. It's not at the forefront of people's minds. And it doesn't necessarily give back as much as you give. And it can be heartbreaking for that reason. But, you know, stay the course, do the job. I would say that you are more than a hitching post. And I would encourage you to continue practicing with the integrity and compassion that you've always had, despite, you know, the garbage fire of a year. I would always recommend taking the time, if you are wanting to get into the equine industry, take the time, use your initiative and your motivation and the connections that you have to start getting as much hands-on experience as you can, not necessarily in the medical realm, but first get your foundation with handling. So, you know, when I was 8 years old and trying to get a pony for my parents, I was mucking stalls so that I could then take horseback riding lessons, right? And by mucking stalls, I gained an appreciation for how horses behave, which meant that I had a better understanding of how to handle them. And just because I was doing it when I was 8 years old does not mean that you miss the train. If you're 20 or you're 30 or you're 40 or you're 50 or you're 60, it's never too late to start learning. So go out and start the foundation of your education by getting as much hands-on experience as you can, kind of on the husbandry level. And then you can start taking the time and the initiative to educating yourself through books and online classes. I mentioned before, the AAVT has a certification program that will pick up where your technician program left off. So you can learn more medical terminology. You can learn more about the things that that you would see in a vet clinic. You would also reestablish what you know in terms of handling, and then get as much hands-on experience as you can on the medical realm. So start putting in applications with the experience and the knowledge that you have for any equine practice that will hire somebody specifically that will train you and mentor you for success. There are going to be practices, just like any practice that you've ever ran into, that it just expects you to start hitting the ground and running. And that is not a practice for a budding equine technician to take on, unless you have the spirit of a mule. That's fine. But you want to avoid toxic situations when perhaps you're learning new things. I think that's just any advice we would give a new technician, no matter what.
Yeah.
To find those places, find the mentorship, find the training, take it upon yourself to learn, and the world is your oyster. And anybody that is interested in advancing their equine their equine technician career, I would say, please do look up the Academy for Equine Veterinary Nursing Technicians. I can be reached at info@aevnt.org. As the president, I'm answering and fielding all of the questions that people may have towards application. We are accepting applications for the 2021 application year now.
Awesome.
And those need to be in by May 1st. And so letters of intent are due on March 15th. And I do hope to hear from anyone that's interested. Again, to be a VTS EVN, you do need to have a sizable amount of equine medical experience on your resume, and you do need to have a credentialing of some kind. So
pretty much like any other VTS, right?
Just like any other VTS. Yeah. I guess I've gotten some weird questions from people sure. that are, they're not even in a technician program at the moment. So they're not weird. They're just, out of left field. So
sure.
That was my qualifier for that one.
Gotcha. Okay.
That's all I have.
kind of piggybacking off of Dave's question there. What, for equine technicians, what do you want to get out to veterinary technicians in other areas, like small animal techs or lab animal techs, like just,
we're just like you. We're just like you, but instead of anal glands, we have reflux, and there's a lot of reflux, just like there's a lot of anal glands. So, I'm afraid there's an unspoken assumption that technicians working in equine medicine are kind of ignorant rednecks. Maybe we're a little lackadaisical. That's not true. You know it. I don't feel like I have to explain that to you. I mean, I might be a bit like of a country bumpkin, but anyone that has met me knows I'm a very type A personality that can be met with anybody else's type A personality down in small animal. And the intelligence and the integrity that surround the equine technician field is extraordinary. And that just needs to be as respected as any other discipline in veterinary technology. I'd say that we're all on the same team, and we deserve a place at the table as well.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Molly. This has been fantastic. We've been talking about this for a couple weeks now, where we're like, oh, we're going to get to actually talk to an equine technician. That's something that we found to be something completely foreign to us, where we're kind of something we, I don't want to say we've forgotten about it, but it's something that we didn't think of when we first started this.
And I'll be honest, I don't really think of small animal too much in my day-to-day either, other than my precious dog.
Yeah, of course.
Sure.
Obviously.
Sure.
So
before we go, I know you've done some research, so you know that you're going to have a Vet Tech Cafe Would You Rather question coming at you.
Yeah, what's coming at me?
All right. Are you ready for it?
Yeah.
We had a few this week, and I think we found one that we both like.
Okay.
Yeah, you can blame me for this one. I just texted Dave to ask
Jeff, what have you done?
And this may play a role into how you handle large animals.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
All right. Would you rather have fingers as short as regular toes, or toes as long as regular fingers?
Oh, toes as long as regular fingers. I would be unstoppable if I had monkey feet.
I love how quick you were. There's no debate.
There's no debate. But you'd have to deal with the short fingers at the end of the day.
But you'd have shorter fingers.
Possibly, I'm sitting here going, "What could I do? There's so much stuff I could do. Why is this even a question?"
But wouldn't you be hampered by the fact you have really short fingers?
I guess we didn't really qualify that.
Oh, don't qualify that. I thought it. Wait, sorry.
Fingers as short as regular toes.
But we didn't really qualify that.
I thought it was like either or, and I was like, I don't want fingers as short as regular toes, but I absolutely will take monkey feet for that situation.
Oh, I see.
No. Okay, wait. No, I just want regular then. Wait. Qualify the question. Did I answer too quickly?
I guess I didn't think about it when I read the question. Yeah. I was like, fingers as short as toe or toes as long as regular. I guess you could have either one, but if you'd rather have, I guess if we thought about it that way, you'd have to have both of those.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I'll wait.
Let's see.
I'm going to stick with what I have then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I have to have fingers long as fingers.
and I would say the other then would just stay the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay the same. I am totally retracting that question.
But if you had toes as long as regular fingers, you'd have to buy all new shoes.
That's okay. Yeah. But here's the thing. I still have to have fingers. And I was willing to be freakish with my feet as long as I still had regular hands.
Yeah.
Because I think that the why the chimpanzee is a superior animal is because it has really long toes and normal hands.
And can pick up stuff with its feet, yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Exactly. You go. Open a banana with my feet. The world is my burrito.
What couldn't you do?
What couldn't I do? Oh my gosh.
I think, Dave, we have to just leave it at that.
Yeah, we have to leave it at that.
Yeah. There's not going to be any better question than that.
No. Well, Molly, thank you so much for your time tonight. Yes. And talking about equine technician medicine, because it's, as we said a number of times through here, like it just is, I'll say, an underrepresented part of the profession that doesn't get enough recognition, but also like attention to it and understanding of what goes on. So, which is a big part of what we're trying to do here at the podcast. So thank you so much for your time, and for your thoughtful responses. And, it was really great chatting with you. And, we have a couple of other friends at Purdue. If I'm ever out there, I would love to, say hello in person, but
I will go buy whoever wants the coffee stout, a coffee stout.
Ooh,
there
yes.
you go.
Yes. Done. Yeah, we would both be in for that. So
okay, good. And if it's in the summer, there's like some fantastic cream ales around, so don't worry.
Come say hi. All right. Thank you so much for your time, Molly.
Thank you for everything you do.
We'll talk to you soon. And thank you to the Vet Tech Caffeinators out there listening. Yes. Hope you enjoyed this episode of the Vet Tech Cafe. All right, bye everybody.
Bye guys.
We would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. We often talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues. As such, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by us as the hosts or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone, and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Lastly, as Dave said during the intro, please like us, follow us, and take a minute to rate and review the Vet Tech Cafe podcast on whatever podcast platform you use. It really does help. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.